Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. School is starting up again very shortly. Many children and adolescents struggle to achieve their maximum potential in school. Often this can be due to an inability to focus, to stay on task, to complete tests and assignments, forgetting to turn in assignments. Often they're impulsive, seem to have much more activity than the average child. Attention deficit disorder, or ADD, is common, but in my mind is still very much misunderstood. Our guest today is Tracy Weiss. Tracy is a psychiatric nurse practitioner. She's got a doctorate degree in nursing, and she's licensed to practice and prescribe and is focusing her attention now on different mental health issues, particularly ADD. We're going to discuss ADD with her today and options that can help those that are affected on this edition of Line One. If you have questions or comments about anything you hear today, I want you to feel free to give us a call. There are several ways you can contact us. Two ways by telephone. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can also reach me during this hour at Line 1, spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, Line 1, all one word, at alaskapublic.org. Tracy, I think this is the first time I've had you on as a guest. We've talked about ADD a couple of times in the number of years I've been doing this, but it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Do you agree that it's misunderstood, or is it just me? Do you find yourself, when you're dealing with someone with ADD, that you have a lot of misconceptions to deal with?
Misconceptions or misinformation. Uh-huh. I think, yeah, it's definitely maybe a better word.
Pretty common disorder?
The most common behavioral disorder for children in America, at least. It's the most commonly diagnosed behavioral disorder.
So let's paint a picture. People are listening. What is ADD? Sometimes you'll hear the word ADHD, meaning hyperactive disorder, attention deficit with hyperactivity. Right. What are we talking about? What do these individuals do that's different?
Well, it's individual. So I think that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions is, so you're going to see a lot of differences between boys and girls, between different ages of children, depending on if they have other disorders going on. But in general, mostly what you're going to see is impulsivity. So doing things without acting, doing things that might put themselves at risk or others at risk. Hyperactivity, not being able to sit still, not being able to stay on task, not being able to follow directions very well. And distractibility, so you know, being very easily pulled away from what they're supposed to be doing.
The public hears those things, and I guess it's like the medical school problem. We all read about something, particularly some psychological or mental health issue, and we all think we've got that. One of the things I like to point out is none of those by themselves are really diagnostic. You can be hyperactive or maybe impulsive or maybe at times inattentive, but not have this diagnosis. Is that fair to say?
Sure. And certainly at different ages, children are naturally somewhat hyperactive or naturally impulsive or naturally distractible. When we're making a diagnosis of ADHD, what we're looking for is a specific constellation of symptoms. And typically we want to see that those symptoms are occurring in more than one environment. So this is not just the child that cannot maintain themselves at school, or not a child that can just not maintain themselves at home or over at friends' houses. We want to see that across the environments the child is participating in, so both at school and at home and out in the community, that they're displaying these same types of behaviors no matter what the environment is.
Why is that important?
That's important so we can rule out that, say, maybe the school classroom is a very busy environment and it's a very noisy environment. You know, it could be perhaps that this child has some sensory deficits or there's something else about the classroom, a classroom bully or, you know, something else about the classroom or that specific environment that's causing the child to display those symptoms.
So often with mental health diagnoses, these symptoms being across the board and broader, more than just one location, is often a very common thread that's important to recognize.
It is. Now, certainly there's things about being at home that can lend a child that has ADHD to have a little bit better behavior. But the biggest piece of making an ADHD diagnosis is having a really in-depth conversation with the caregiver of the child, and also getting some feedback from teachers and other adults that are in the child's life about what these behaviors look like.
Another thing about mental health issues is it seems like the issue of how much it's affecting your life, how much it's affecting daily function, becomes important, because we all may be distractible in a certain situation, or we may be going through some situational things that are making this a problem. So is that true with ADD as well, or our attention deficit disorder, is that it is part of the diagnosis, is that it has to be impairing function in more than one, or in a couple of places, or at least in school?
Absolutely. So when we look at a child, you know, especially say a younger child who is naturally a little hyperactive or impulsive, and we're on that cusp of, do we make the diagnosis, or is this age appropriate behavior? A lot of times it really comes down to function. So is this child able to make friends, keep friends, and participate in a social level that's developmentally appropriate for a child in that age bracket? Are they, you know, succeeding in the academic arena in a way that's conducive to their intellectual level? Are they able to follow expectations at home without having to, you know, constantly be receiving consequences for not being able to do chores or things correctly? Mm-hmm. So that functionality piece is certainly huge.
At least in my experience, that it is, at least in the school-age child, it's primarily difficulties in school that brings these individuals to at least my attention. Is that typically the situation?
It is typical of school-age children. And preschool children, if a child has a diagnosis as a preschool child, we know that's typically because they've had significantly impaired or disruptive behaviors, typically in the daycare environment. And the same is true for school-age children. A lot of times what we see, as expectations for children increase, the symptoms of ADHD typically get worse, especially if you don't have a diagnosis or don't have some type of environmental adjustment or treatment. As those expectations increase, the child with ADHD is going to be less likely to be able to meet the demands of the academic arena. And so, yes, a lot of times, if the child hasn't been diagnosed as a preschooler, then typically once they start school, they're expected to sit down, raise their hand, turn in assignments. As their expectations in life increase, the struggle level goes up.
Mm-hmm. What are some factors? I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, there are kids who maybe have the right milieu at home, or the right teacher, or intellectually they're a little bit more above average. So those are factors that might impact on when this becomes a problem, earlier versus later in school age group.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely accurate.
So are there protective factors then for how much this can affect functionality besides just having? Say you got two kids with almost identical kinds of problems. One doesn't really seem to come to a attention till, you know, junior high school or high school. Another one's having trouble very early on. Are there significant differences that have been related to why that might be?
I think there could be a lot of factors. One of the most important aspects when you're comparing two children that have ADHD and asking yourself why one might be functioning and why not the other, the first thing to look at always is what's going on in the home environment. So is the home environment that the child is in, is that a safe and consistent and structured environment? Is it an environment where the child has clear expectations? The schedule is consistent, the routine is consistent, and certainly we always want to, you know, ask ourselves the question of, is the environment that the child in at home, is it safe for them? You know, sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect of care, caregiver substance abuse, emotional abuse. If these things are occurring in the home and a child has ADHD, typically you're going to see their function level at school is going to be much worse than the child who has a safe and nurturing environment at home where there's clear expectations and the routine is known and the schedule stays fairly consistent.
Let me remind listeners once again, if you don't mind, Tracy, we're listening to Line One. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Tracy Weiss, a psychiatric nurse practitioner, and she does a lot of her day-to-day work addressing attention deficit disorders in children, and that's our topic today. If you've got questions or comments in Anchorage, our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. You also can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. If you're out of town, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So how common is it? You said it's one of the most common mental health diagnoses in children?
Yeah, most common behavioral disorder diagnosed. It depends on which research study you look at, but in most prevalence rates that you're going to see are going to be anywhere between 5 to 10% of our pediatric population meets criteria for an ADHD diagnosis. We also know that's significantly split between the genders. So boys are much more likely to receive an ADHD diagnosis, and specific prevalence rates for boys are about twice that as girls. So boys, about 12% of the general population of boys have an ADHD diagnosis as compared to about 6% of girls. And there's a lot of different reasons for that, but what I see anecdotally in my practice is most of the time boys' behaviors are much more disruptive than girls that have ADHD. And oftentimes boys are getting diagnosed more frequently and earlier than female children because their behaviors are more disruptive. So there's more letters home to parents. There's more instances of, you know, male children being kicked out of preschools or whatnot for their aggressive behavior that could be related to ADHD. And so oftentimes girls may go undiagnosed, or they may not be diagnosed till much later, say fourth or fifth grade, when the academic work starts to get harder and their focus becomes an issue. So boys typically are more disruptive.
What about by age? A later question was, does ADD persist into adulthood? So I might as well bring that question in now. When is it appropriate to make the diagnosis, and then does the prevalence by age change very much?
Yeah, so about 60% of children or adolescents with ADHD will progress into adulthood and still meet criteria for an ADHD diagnosis, so about roughly half. And that can be for a lot of different reasons. Sometimes those few extra years of frontal lobe development, that front part of the brain is the area of the brain that controls things like impulse control, planning, organizing, focusing, and that's the part of the brain that develops last. So oftentimes, as children age, their brain becomes better at regulating those symptoms that we see. So a lot of children age out, basically, of their ADHD diagnosis. Sometimes later in life, children or adolescents can have head injuries to the front part of their brain. So sometimes we can see, children actually meeting criteria for an ADHD diagnosis later in life. And again, the age of the diagnosis typically, in my experience, depends on the level of disruption of the behavior. Because again, this isn't a physical illness per se, so the child isn't coming home complaining of headaches and stomach aches. And, you know, so unless parents are getting some feedback that the way their child behaves is a little bit different than other children, especially maybe for first-time parents who don't have a whole lot of experience as far as what's normal for children, or if the child doesn't have very aggressive behavior or hyperactive behavior, then things may go unnoticed for a while. Mm-hmm.
And when it goes unnoticed, it's usually academic failure that brings them in, and is my understanding, at least in my experience, I think that's fair to say. And I remember talking to someone at some time about that, is that in schools, it's about third grade, there's a big change in, you know, you're listening and just receiving information. Third grade, you start asked to put stuff out. So that's the time, junior high school, college, there's different areas where you're more likely to start seeing patients. And often it's right after reports cards come out.
Yeah, I would agree with that, definitely. I like to refer to that as the fourth grade brick wall. Yeah.
So as the demands increase, the ability of a child to stay on task, complete assignments, be organized, and so forth begins to catch up with them at some point, and it can be difficult. But it may not be because of behavior, as you said, like with girls or with certain boys, and so they may go relatively unnoticed for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. So you may see, you know, a child in their sophomore, or, you know, I have a handful of patients who are in their sophomore or junior year of high school, and they're really struggling. They've done fine in school up until now, but now they're driving and they're working a few hours a week, and, you know, they're not very focused behind the wheel. They may have gotten into a car accident or two. You know, these big assignments that require long-term planning towards the end of high school, where you've got 6 months of planning, you know, leading up to creating a portfolio. You know, they've never really struggled with school, but now we're seeing them struggle in school. And, you know, gosh, when we send those questionnaires to the teachers or even to the parents, well, yeah, they've got a lot, you know, they're not focusing in a lot of areas of their life. So oftentimes, you know, we may be diagnosing 13, 14, 15-year-olds with ADHD for the first time.
So there's a broad spectrum of symptoms revolving around hyperactivity, impulsivity, and attention, it sounds like. Those are kind of the cornerstone things we're looking for.
Exactly.
What's the etiology? What's the cause? Where does this come from? Is it a disease? Is it a disorder? Is it with 5 or 10% of the population has it? What are we dealing with here?
Yeah, and I wish we had a straightforward answer to that. Gosh, there's a lot of research being done, especially in mental health, about where these things come from. Doing a lot of research myself and reading a lot of research, I think I'm on the epigenetic bandwagon. And what I mean by that is epigenetics is sort of the buzzword right now for both physical and mental illness, but certainly mental illness. And that's where we're looking at this sort of fascinating, in my opinion, interplay of genetics and environment. So to date, there's been more than 10 genes that have been identified as having possibly some type of contributing responsibility, if you will, for increasing somebody's susceptibility to getting ADHD or having a diagnosis of ADHD, but there hasn't been a single gene that's been identified as saying, yes, I'm here and I'm going to cause ADHD. So there's an ever-growing school of thought that believes that really the etiology of ADHD is much more likely, and most mental illness is much more likely to be explained by a combination of environmental causes. So what the child has been exposed to both in utero and after they're born, how much work the family is doing with the child at home, what type of toxins and nutrition and other things the child is being exposed to at home, and how those things are affecting the way genes are actually expressed in the child, if that makes sense. So it's this interplay of genes in the environment that's likely thought to be the most likely cause of ADHD. There's been some other research, too. So we know that children who are premature, so infants that are born between 34 and 36 weeks, there's some research that shows that those babies are actually 70% more likely to develop an ADHD diagnosis when you compare them with infants that were born full term. So there's some other very specific things that can increase a child's risk for ADHD.
Let's stay with the genetics and so forth a little bit. Is your understanding, your reading suggest that often it's a familial trait that may or may not be expressed in various amounts, maybe because of environmental influences, as you've alluded to through what we now think of as epigenetic mechanisms?
Right. So what I tell my families is that if, as a parent, you have at any time in your life been diagnosed with ADHD, your children are 50% more likely to have an ADHD diagnosis.
There are other environmental factors that have clearly been associated with ADHD-like problems. I'm thinking of lead toxicity. I'm thinking of fetal alcohol exposure.
Sure.
And head traumas, for example.
Yeah.
Are those different entities that have similar manifestations, or are we talking the same animal here?
That's a good question. You know, neuroscience and mental health and all of this stuff is something that, unfortunately, we are, I believe, learning more and more every day how little we know. So in mental health, the hard part is that, you know, as of right now, we don't have a reliable lab test that can tell us, you know, yes, for sure, this is what's going on with your child behaviorally. The central nervous system, so the brain and the spinal cord, this is a complex area of the body. So yes, ultimately what you're seeing in the classroom, what you're seeing at home are, you know, list A of behaviors or list B of behaviors. As far as what's going on in the brain to cause the child to have those behaviors. Could be ADHD, could be fetal alcohol syndrome, could be that they've had a head injury. You know, there's multiple different pathways that could be affected that would cause a child to be hyperactive. So there's definitely can be a lot of different things going on with a child that would cause them to meet criteria for an ADHD diagnosis, if that makes sense.
Sure. What about, let's say, the differential diagnosis? In medical terms, that means what are things that, as a provider, you need to be careful about making sure this person in front of you doesn't have something else that may appear to be attention deficit? Are there things that you personally worry about? I know there's a long list of things that you think about, but personally, what are the things that you really want to make sure you check off your list or think about or delve into a little bit more before you make the diagnosis?
Sure. Well, as a nurse practitioner, you know, my approach is what most patients would be, you know, familiar with as a medical appointment. So in my mind, I'm first going to be thinking of you know, getting a good medical history and making sure, like you said, things like lead toxicity aren't an issue, head injuries, thyroid problems, you know, other genetic conditions. So my medical brain is going to be thinking about, you know, wanting to make sure this child has had regular medical care, or at least that those things have been ruled out and they've had some lab work done, especially before we start them on medications, and that those things have all been looked at. Now, those are the more rare things for causing symptoms like that, but we always want to rule those out, at least in my approach as a medical provider. But when we can rule those things out and we start looking at neurobehavioral disorders or mental illness, we are looking at a long list of differentials. Again, getting that medical history and I want to know if during the mom's pregnancy with this baby, I want to know if there was cigarettes being used. I want to know if any other drugs or alcohol was being used, you know, during what trimesters and when that use stopped. I want to know about the birth itself and if there was any, you know, need for the baby to have oxygen or resuscitation, because that might tell me that, hey, you know, there could have been a lack of oxygen for this baby at birth. We could be dealing with some other type of brain injury or anoxic brain injury that may have occurred. In that vein, I want to know if the child's ever been, you know, had a head injury or lost consciousness. So we always want to rule out organic causes for these types of symptoms. But about 2/3 of children that have ADHD also meet criteria for another either behavioral or neurodevelopmental diagnosis. So oppositional defiant disorder is a behavioral, it's not a mental illness per se, but it's a behavioral diagnosis that basically speaks to children who have high levels of oppositionality and defiance, so much so that it's, again, affecting their functionality in the school and home. And about 40% of children that have ADHD also could meet criteria for this diagnosis. So frustrated parents who are wondering, you know, how to get a handle on behaviors, you know, you may find that your child also struggles with oppositional defiant disorder. And so oftentimes, too, children with ADHD have other learning disorders that could make it difficult for them to function in school. So we want to make sure that we've done maybe some testing in school if they're really struggling academically, to make sure that the child also doesn't have dyslexia or some other type of math, you know, dysfunction disorder that also could be affecting them. And then it's really important to get a family history, because children that have ADHD, about, you know, depending on which research study you look at, about 10 to 30% of the time also have a co-occurring either mood or anxiety disorder. So if there is a family history of things like bipolar disorder or depression or anxiety, the anxious child looks a lot like the attention deficit child. So they're fidgety, they can't sit still, they forget things. I mean, anybody that experiences anxiety knows that it's difficult to focus. So we also want to look at things like anxiety and depression to make sure that those things aren't also going on.
And particularly that anxiety issue, it seems like, or poor or high-risk home social situations are the reasons why it's pediatricians think it's dangerous to make the diagnosis of ADHD in preschool children. It's mm-hmm. just it's much more difficult to really feel comfortable with what's going on sometimes without a lot more detail about family history and other things you've mentioned.
I would agree with you. I hesitate to make an ADHD diagnosis in a preschool child. And I really, really hesitate to start a preschool child on medication. I don't have any, you know, solid research in front of me, but I in my experience, a significant portion of my clients are, you know, those that have experienced significant levels of trauma in their life. So sexual abuse, physical abuse, exposure to domestic violence, even homes where parents are arguing verbally. What we're learning about the exposure of a child to even verbal arguments between caregivers, loud verbal altercations, we know that this is just as damaging to the developing neurological system as physical assault to a child. So when there's frequent moves, when there's frequent toxic stress in a home, it's my experience that my preschool age children, my littlest patients, it's my experience that in general, those children also are experiencing significant levels of chaos at home. And if we don't get a handle on those social pieces, if we don't give families the tools and resources to address those safety and structure and consistency issues at home, oftentimes we do see kids misdiagnosed or they're diagnosed with ADHD, but nobody ever, you know, stops to think about those other pieces. And what I tell all of my families is that mental health care is a pizza, and we can get the medications in. That's one piece. You can come to your appointments. That's another piece. But man, you're left with 10 other pieces that, as your provider, I can't do anything about. And those things are sleep and nutrition and safety. And nurturing, and you know, for a lot of people, a spiritual connection. And so if you don't have all the pieces there, then your mental health care pizza is not going to be whole, and there's going to be things that are lacking.
I can't pass up the opportunity to talk about this early childhood trauma experience as having a consequence of lifelong experiences and lifelong effects on health. Especially because you're here, but because we've talked about it before and because it's a relatively new recognition, and you've alluded to it a number of times. And what the way I've told parents about this is our brain is a extremely exquisite learning organ. It is not an good unlearning organ. So you can teach yourself to ride a bike, and 90 years later, you're pretty good at riding a bike if you really practice at it again, suggesting that something has happened physically in your brain that is going to live with you the rest of your life. Now let's focus on early childhood trauma as in those first 3 to 4 to 5 years of life, how you're seeing people interact, whether or not you feel safe, what's happening with your adrenaline under stress. All of those, it appears, are apt to have long-term physical changes that can lead us to various and sundry different medical problems.
Yes. I'm giddy getting out of my chair. I love any opportunity to talk about the effects of early childhood trauma. It's one of my biggest soapboxes, especially when we're talking about mental health diagnoses. Fascinating stuff, and we could probably talk for another 3 hours. But what we're learning more and more every day is that when children are exposed to what we're referring to as adverse childhood experiences, so again, the things that I've already alluded to, sexual abuse, multiple moves in the home, caregiver substance abuse, an emotionally vacant or absent parent, you know, small things such as divorce or even things like a parent going to jail. We're now in the medical and mental health community referring to these things as adverse childhood experiences, and it doesn't matter, you know, how many times these things occur. We're starting to assign, you know, a number for each one of these types of experiences, and we're referring to that as the ACE score. And as the ACE score of a child increases, so as a child is exposed to multiple types of trauma, it creates what we're referring to as toxic levels of stress. And for the developing brain, so those very first few early years of life are some of the most important for emotional and behavioral control, attachment, whether or not a child feels safe. And so if a child is exposed to multiple forms of trauma in those first few years of life, we know now fascinating things are happening to those children later in life. There's actual changes being made to the way their genes are being expressed. There's physical changes to the way their brains are developed. Their brains are developed in what I like to tell patients is a soup of stress. And so stress creates hormones and chemicals in the brain. And when a child's brain develops in this chronic soup of stress, the brain never really learns how to function not under stress. And so as these children age, they really struggle with being able to regulate themselves in any environment. And one of the most fascinating things that we're finding out about exposure to early childhood trauma is it's not only affecting mental health, but it's actually causing chronic illness. And so even when we take away when we control for things like smoking, children who have been exposed to early childhood trauma are more likely to develop lung cancer, even if they've never smoked, than somebody who never was exposed to childhood trauma and never smoked. So it's a whole fascinating area of research. But we cannot help children that have behavioral conditions if we're not also looking at what's going on in the home and whether or not this child is safe, and in the family unit, whether or not the family unit knows how to create a safe and structured environment and whether or not they have the resources to do so.
Yeah, it's an extremely important part of our understanding of human development.
Absolutely.
Right now. It's been a fast 30 minutes. We're past halfway through. I've got a caller on the line. I will get to that caller, but we need to take our mid-break. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll continue our conversation about attention deficit disorder with Tracy Weiss. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media, originating in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, our topic is attention deficit disorder. Sometimes you may be referred to as ADD or ADHD. My guest is Anchorage psychiatric nurse practitioner Tracy Weiss. Up to this point, we've spent some time kind of defining the term, as I'd like to think of it, as painting the picture of these individuals who may have this problem. And one of the things I want people to really hopefully hear, and it's not always easy, is this can be a very difficult, very complex problem that seems to the public to be fairly straightforward. It's not always the case, and you have to be very, very careful about getting the right diagnosis, without which it's hard to give the right suggested treatment. Please remember also, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday evening, that's a rebroadcast. It won't be available. You can always go back to alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 link, and listen to this podcast at your convenience, however, as well. All right, we're going to continue. If you have email questions, email us at line1@alaskapublic.org, our local number 550-8433. We lost our caller, but we do have an email that has come in. It says, and this is a fairly common question nowadays, any comments on technologies, particularly interruptive technologies, in ADD? What are the implications and overuse of technologies? I think when people say this, I think we're often talking about screens, video screens, and so forth.
Yeah.
And there's been some discussion, some studies, some evidence. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, good question. I don't even think that question really is, I mean, it's not even specifically an ADHD question. In general, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and you'll have to correct me, Dr. Woodard, if they've changed the recommendation, but in general, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends absolutely no more than 2 hours total of screen time for a child a day. And in my opinion, that's a pretty generous recommendation. And as a parent, you have to understand that, that's a combination of, cell phones, computers, TV, video games, no more than 2 hours. And that number is basically what we know, because any more than that per day can start to have some effects to a child's neurological development, and a lot of times more subjectively their social skill, whether or not they have appropriate social skills, and definitely I have seen a lot of children who have extended periods of screen time develop a lot of sleep-wake disorders, so it's being linked now to more and more issues behaviorally and emotionally with children. Now, that being said, there's also a lot of technologies being used to treat children with ADHD. So specifically things like biofeedback, where the child is, electrodes are placed on the brain, and children are actually using video games to train their brains how to focus better. The evidence is still out on that as to whether or not we're seeing, clinically significant differences in whether or not technology can be helpful for treating ADHD. But in general, it's good to stick to that recommendation.
Yeah, the academy's not only perhaps related to attentional issues, but if you're spending lots and lots of time on screens, then there's a lot of things you aren't doing, like exercising,
right,
and interacting socially with people, learning social skills. This is one, Tracy, that I have to say I'm a little bit skeptical about. And one day as I was driving, listening to a report on this, it dawned on me, I wonder what people were saying when books got written, you know? Here's a book. Now we don't talk to each other as much. My son goes up and reads a book all day, doesn't go out and exercise at all. And today, if you told me I was spending a lot of time reading books, I wouldn't be too upset about that. So I think we got to be a little careful. It's probably quantity and what you're doing,
right,
and a lot of other things together, but
balance.
Yeah, I had to put that in some frame of reference.
Yeah.
I may be wrong. I am not saying anything other than let's evaluate the evidence really, really good on this. Okay, so let's take a call here. We got several. Andrew, you're on line one. What can I do for you?
Hello, yeah. My question is, I recently had a situation where I met my nephew after being long gone for a while, and he just graduated, barely got through it from high school, and he was early diagnosed with ADD. However, I noticed other things that were trending of murmuring, talking to himself a lot, and I don't want to say that there was distractions of voices or anything. I don't like to go to that realm, but have you ever diagnosed somebody with ADD that has those type of attitudes or behavior?
Yeah, that's a good question. So definitely, when you say murmurs, you mean like murmuring to himself?
Yeah, he'll just, it'll be quiet in the room, or people will be socializing, and then he's just kind of smiling and, just alone by himself. He doesn't walk next to you. He's about 10 feet behind you and grocery stores, and that might be more anxiety, I guess.
Yeah, well, what you're doing is creating the differential diagnosis. And so it would
right,
take a full, unfortunately, I wish I had a good answer for you, but it would take a full psychiatric assessment to determine, when he is murmuring to himself, if that's an actual, distortion of reality, or if it's a coping skill for him. Like you said, if it's a, reaction just to maybe having some deficits in appropriate level social skills, or like you said, there might be anxiety. So again, there's a lot of overlap between ADHD and other mental health diagnoses. And so if you have a family member or a friend that's having, things like that, oftentimes as somebody that cares about them, it's just helpful maybe to reflect back to them like, hey, I noticed that these things were going on. Have you ever talked to somebody about that? Or,
sure,
might be good to go tell somebody that those things are going on, or that I observed those things.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm afraid schizophrenia runs in his side of the family, and I just I want to catch it early and just kind of be a part of the process.
Yeah.
Let me say this. I guess if you're talking about a high school age kid who's doing that, it to me, and I'm going to ask Tracy to butt in if I'm out of respect. I think it's unusual enough that it seems to me it'd be worth trying to get evaluated.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, whether it's ADD, not particularly. I think there's more going on.
Sounds like there's some other things going on, especially with that family history. It would be a really good idea to go get in, yeah.
Yep. Right, definitely.
Good,
so
good luck, yeah.
Yep. All right, let's try another call. Mike, you're on line one.
Yeah. Hey, as children, me and most of my brothers were diagnosed with severe ADHD. We were quite the problem children for my mom, you know. And later on in life, we, for the most part, lost the hyperactivity portion of it. But it seems like the ADD can cause problems with adult relationships whenever the other party has no idea that it truly isn't an excuse. In some cases, that's an actual genuine reason. So in other words, my question is, what is good for the general public who do not suffer ADHD to know so they can be compassionate and helpful in dealing with relationships in that way?
That is an excellent question. And what you have just described is basically the picture-perfect adult ADHD patient. So the reason that adults grow out of the hyperactivity piece is, again, that frontal lobe, that front part of the brain, is the last part to develop. And that's the part of the brain that says, okay, it's not socially acceptable to climb out of my chair and, you know, wipe my boogers on the wall and do other things. You know, so we develop the capacity to control our impulses. And so, yes, as adolescence subsides and that front part of the brain typically isn't fully developed until about 25. And so once you get to be that age, you don't have those hyperactive pieces. And so, yes, then those inattentive pieces, we see them getting adults in trouble in work and intimate relationships. And those are the two places where adults with ADHD struggle. And their partners oftentimes think that they're forgetful on purpose or that they don't remember things. And so, you know, I wish I had a concrete reference for you, but there are a number of books for partners of people that have ADHD. But, you know, I would say if I was working with a couple particularly, I would have them, you know, probably write down some really clear expectations about, you know, have the person that's struggling with ADD to actually physically write down, you know, these are the areas that I really struggle with and here's why. But it would probably be a different process for each couple. But it's definitely something that's not uncommon for couples to struggle with, because that inattentive can look like you're checked out of the relationship or like you don't care about the relationship, when really it's that your brain may not have the ability to focus on the minute pieces of conversation, or you interrupt frequently, or you have a hard time listening to extended responses to questions like I'm giving you. So
that was a good answer. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Have a good afternoon, Michael.
You too.
All right, let's take one more call, and then I want to spend some time with Tracy talking about treatment options. Kelly, you're on line one.
Hey there. I have a son who was diagnosed with ADD before he graduated high school, but nothing really ever came of it because I could not get him to take his medication on a regular basis. Now he's over 18. He's an adult. He can take it or not take it, but he is checked out of what is the next step, college or work or what have you. He needs to figure out what he's doing, but he's got medication that's been prescribed to him, but I don't know where to turn resources or how to move forward to get him to engage in something in life. What do you do then?
Oh, well, if I had you in my office, I would tell you part of that's going to be let go. you know, he needs to engage. There's a lot of things that you could do to support him, though. If he is interested in going to college, then, you know, one of my tips that I was going to share was, you know, to contact the campus student with disability office, because if a young adult does have an ADHD diagnosis, there are certain things that can be done even in the college environment to augment the learning experience to make it more, you know, up his alley, or something that's going to work a little bit better for him. Extended testing times, you know, testing outside of the classroom. It's not uncommon for young adults with ADHD to have a difficult time getting motivated. There's a really good article. If you Google 50 Tips on the Management of Adult ADHD. It is the first article that pops up, and it is an excellent, it's long, it's like 11 pages, and so what I typically recommend is that patients go through there and highlight, you know, the one or two things that jump out at them. But it separates the recommendations into like academic, work, community, social, and there's some really good suggestions in there for young adults that have ADHD about how to sort of start planning and getting motivated, because it's not an uncommon problem, but my experience with patients that age is that until they engage and have a desire to sort of start going down that road, it can be a lot of lost effort on the people that care about them's part, trying to, you know, to force them down that road. So I think presenting him with some support and options that are out there and available would be a good place to get started.
And when you are referring to it as ADHD, what I was told was it was really ADD, or like executive functioning is really the problem, so not really the hyperactivity side of it. Are we still talking apples to apples here?
Right, yes. So he, again, age-appropriate struggles, so that executive functioning is those things that you're seeing him struggle with, which is planning, organizing, and sort of, you know, being able to create that plan for where things are going to be a year from now.
Yeah, there's just no motivation or engagement in life in general, so it's a worry.
Well, and the other thing to consider if there's lack of motivation is whether or not he might be struggling with depression or some what we call acute stress disorder, which is common when adolescents transition into young adulthood. And so it may be helpful for him also to, you know, establish a rapport and maybe talk to somebody about where that lack of motivation is coming from.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about treatment.
Yeah.
Let me just leave it open to you. I want to at least make sure we talk about non-medication. So many people think that's the only option, which is not true.
Right.
So tell us about treatment.
Sure. So this is a pretty common conversation that I have with families every day. Treatment for ADHD involves both non-pharmacological interventions, so non-medication options, and medication options. And for a lot of families, more and more these days, they are trying more integrative modalities, so things like acupuncture or nutritional changes. The first thing that I would say is the things that you can do that don't involve medication are structure, consistency, schedule. So trying to make sure the schedule at home for your child, especially if they're young, is consistent, and that there might be some visual cues, so pictures, lists, you know, things that your child can see to help them along their way. There's also some emerging evidence that omega-3s, so taking fish oil, has a lot of beneficial properties to mood and behavior. So there actually is research that shows some small reduction in ADHD symptoms in children that are on omega-3 supplementation. But what the clinical significance of that reduction is sort of remains to be seen. A lot of parents have questions about things like artificial food coloring and preservatives. And what the research for that shows is that for children that have food sensitivities, you know, eliminating processed foods and specific food dyes from their diet, especially specific allergens, can be helpful in reducing ADHD symptoms. But for the population of children that don't have food sensitivities, that have ADHD, making changes to their diet, we don't really see a whole lot of effect on their symptoms. There's also different therapeutic modalities that families can engage in to help their children. I've already mentioned one, the biofeedback. This will depend on what your insurance coverage is, where you're located, as far as if there's a provider in your area who, you know, has experience in biofeedback. Certainly we have providers here in Anchorage and Eagle River in the Valley. Outside of that, I'm not sure who's doing biofeedback. There's also, you know, just regular talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy can have some small effect on things like thinking patterns, coping skills, you know, working on planning. So therapy can help with those things. But what the research tells us is that for ADHD, the most robust or the largest reduction in symptoms is going to come from a combination of those things with medication. And when we use those things together, the child, you know, is going to have a better chance of meeting their full potential. Now, that being said, that certainly have many families who don't want to explore medication options, and that's fine too. So with regard to medications, you know, most people are familiar with the central nervous system stimulants. So these are things like Ritalin and Adderall. And there is, you know, tens upon tens of different brand names, and there's new medications coming out. You know, it seems like every year, as far as new stimulant medications, they come in patches and liquids in tablet form, extended release, quick release. So every child medication regimen is probably going to look a little bit different depending on a lot of things, their medical history, you know, their height, their weight, whether or not they have any growth issues. But those stimulants work on those areas of the brain that are affected by ADHD. Basically, what they're doing is increasing dopamine, and then when you have increased dopamine, you have increased norepinephrine, and the ADHD brain is actually a pretty lazy brain, and so those extra neurotransmitters sort of, you know, gets things going the way they need to be going. Stimulants have been around for a long time, and what we know in psychiatry is that stimulants are really our safest, quickest option for treating behavioral kids with behavioral conditions like ADHD. So the nice thing about stimulants is that you take them and they work really quickly. And so typically we can even do a trial of like a week of a medication. And so a family can sort of feel out how the child behaves on the medication. And you'll typically see a really nice, robust response.
The risk-benefit ratio is something I try to talk about all the time on this program. So let's start with the basic risk-benefit ratio. What do we know about outcome of untreated, unaddressed ADHD versus treated or addressed ADHD?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the most fascinating things to me that I've read recently about untreated ADHD is actually, you know, I have a lot of parents that come to me and they're concerned about their child with ADHD getting addicted, quote unquote, to the medications that were being prescribed. And what I like to share with them is that a lot of research now is showing us that actually not treating ADHD and letting a child who has ADHD progress without addressing those symptoms, actually those children are much higher risk to begin substance abuse behavior in adolescence and young adulthood, because what they do is they start to self-medicate for not being able to function the way that they should be functioning. And so your child is actually much less likely to participate in substance abuse behaviors if you treat the ADHD both behaviorally and pharmacologically.
Side effects of medication then?
Yeah.
Significant, How much of a problem are they?
For the healthy child, the stimulant side effect profile is pretty low. For the child that doesn't have growth, chronic growth conditions, and the child that doesn't have, a family history of early cardiac death or other cardiac issues, stimulant medications are pretty safe. A lot of times what families will tell you is that the most common side effect they're noticing is a decreased appetite. And so we do know that stimulants decrease the appetite. And for some kids, they decrease the appetite so strongly that we actually have to, they can't be on the stimulants because they're losing too much weight. Other, mild side effects, things like stomach ache and headache and other things you get with almost any medication are typically mild and they'll subside if you continue with the medication. Now, if there is a co-occurring mood disorder or other behavioral disorders going on, then sometimes the stimulants can make children more irritable. They sometimes can even cause aggression in children, especially in children with trauma histories or anxiety disorders and other co-occurring disorders. But for a healthy child that doesn't have any co-occurring disorders, stimulants are almost always a really safe option to at least trial for a short period of time to see the effect.
And so what I've heard you say is no one is saying that medication alone is the best treatment. Nobody is that what we know from long-term studies is medication along with non-pharmacological ways of addressing a person's other problems, learning disabilities, anxiety, mood, depression, helping them learn to organize, not to forget things and so forth. Those things together is the best things we have available right now for helping these individuals.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And it seems to me that when the diagnosis is correct, it is amazing how well some individuals do. In fact, when I don't get a good response, I start wondering what's going on.
That's my wondering what's going on at home, you know, wondering what else is going on, wondering if they're taking the medication,
right.
You know, wondering
right.
how compliance is for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So blood pressure can be a problem. Sometimes you mentioned the eating is a problem sometimes, but generally it seems like these are relatively safe, relatively effective, but by themselves, not all that most kids need with this.
I would say probably never all a kid needs.
Okay.
And I know we're running out of time, but there certainly are some options for medication that aren't stimulants, because some families, you know, some kids can't take them, and then some families just are not comfortable with that stimulant option. And so there are other options that are non-stimulant that are out there for kids, too.
One more email. Could nail biting as a distraction behavior be associated with ADD?
It could be, yeah. I mean, certainly kids that fidget or they do have what we call body-focused repetitive behavior patterns is what I would refer that to. It can be a part of ADHD. It also could be a part of something like an anxiety disorder. You know, we need the full clinical picture, I guess, to sort of decide what that's a part of.
If I were to say, what's the most common misconception or education about ADHD that you run into, how would you answer that?
I would say there's two. I would say the first one is that you know, that the stimulant medications are really risky and that it's going to cause the child to become addicted to them. And I would say the other common misconception is that these are bad kids that, you know, that choose to have negative behavior, which is simply just not the case. Not all the time. Certainly all kids have chosen negative behavior, but, you know, these aren't bad kids.
Last minute or so, I like to end by having you summarize the important things you want people to most likely remember from today's conversation.
Oh, the pizza, the mental health care pizza. That's the one walkaway, takeaway from this hour, is that, you know, the medications are one piece, but so much of the rest of the pizza are things that your provider cannot participate in. So nutrition, sleep, all those other pieces have to be there for you to have a full picture of mental health.
And we really didn't mention sleep, but there's clearly an association between not having enough sleep for various reasons, including videos, and having symptoms suggestive of ADHD or ADD.
Yeah, about half of kids that have ADHD also have some type of sleep dysfunction, which most parents will probably nod and laugh about because they know.
Yeah. One more thing. An observation that I've noticed is that many kids with attention problems often are very artsy. They're very good in art. They're very good in drawing. They're very creative as a group of people, sometimes in science, sometimes even in engineering. Have you ever seen that written about? Do you make that association? Or, Dr. Woodard, you are one crazy dude.
No, I would say anecdotally, I would probably agree with you. I don't know. I don't know if there's been any research done on, you know, creativity or more artistic brain activities in kids with ADHD. But certainly if kids aren't excelling in the academic environment, they're going to turn to other activities that they do excel in. And oftentimes kids with ADHD can focus very well on things that they really like.
Yeah, they're really motivated by.
Yes.
Which is another strategy sometimes if educators would let kids do assignments related to things they are turned on by.
Yeah.
It can help them accomplish them.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Yeah,
it's been a pleasure. A very quick hour.
Yeah.
My thanks to today's guest, psychiatric nurse practitioner Tracy Weiss. And if you want to continue the discussion on ADD, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link at our website, alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the Line 1 archives. Healthcare is more complex than ever. Chronic diseases are certainly a major focus. Costs, access, and quality are problems. Dr. Barbara Berner is director of the UAA School of Nursing, and she's going to be our guest talking about the changing roles of nurses in healthcare on our next Line 1 Your Health Connection next Monday at 2 p.m. on FM 91.1. Pat Yak is chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson is our audio engineer today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.